Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Lunas, and today I'm here with one of our very favorite writers, Sarah Jaffe, who you probably know from her many, many journalistic articles that we have linked to over the years, not to mention her first book from 2016, Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, which I have used in my classes many, many times over the last 5 years. And we're here today to talk about her latest book, which I also just used in one of my classes, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone, which is published by Bold Type Books, which is part of the Hachette Group, earlier this year. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I guess we'll just start by, could you just give us an overview of the book and how you started writing about this really critical topic?
So yeah, work. It's bad, actually. I've been writing about work for a very long time, what feels like a million years now, although I guess it's been like 12 or 13 professionally anyway. And, you know, when I got started trying to be a labor journalist in the middle of the, 2008 collapse of everything, there were not that many people who were doing that work and who are taking labor unions, but also just like the questions about our relationship to work and the control it has over our lives very seriously. And that has changed now, which is great. There's a lot of us, although, the journalism industry itself still sucks. And so I had been thinking about sort of these questions of why we're expected to love our jobs, which kinds of jobs we're expected to love, how that became the paradigm by which we are supposed to understand our relationship to work, and sort of the historical bounds of this question, right? Because like, actually it's not a very old expectation that we should love our jobs. I'm talking to a historian of these things, so you can tell me whether my history is correct. But, I started thinking about this as something that was essentially a product of neoliberalism, that this was a reaction of needing to keep people working because the capitalist system requires that we work in order to get the things we need, while also not really needing our labor anymore for the work of production. So that's the short answer of what the book is about, told through the story of 10 different workers in 10 different industries that realized that work was not going to love them back and in some way organized around that to change that.
Yeah. I mean, I want to talk about the history a little bit too, but I thought, one thing I know you've been interested in for a long time is the concept of emotional labor.
Yes.
And I think that has so many different facets. And your book obviously talks about some of them. So could you talk a little bit more about what emotional labor is and maybe some of the ways in which it frames or shapes the ways in which we work?
Yeah. So the idea of emotional labor, as coined by sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild in the 80s with a study of flight attendants and debt collectors, is that certain kinds of work require us to manage, control, produce our own emotions in order to produce emotions in someone else. So if you are a flight attendant, you have to make sure that the people who are getting on the plane are happy, comfortable, safe, and are not going to be disruptive when the plane is taking off or anything that could cause, massive destruction. If you are a debt collector, on the other hand, you have to intimidate people into thinking that bad things will happen to them if they don't pay their debts. And in both of those cases, it doesn't really matter what you feel in that moment. In fact, if you are having a feeling contradictory to the thing you are trying to do, you basically just have to stuff it down there and smile no matter how rude the person in the plane just has been to you, or gin yourself up to be really angry, even if you're just like having a nice day and you feel good about the world, which, who feels good about the world these days, but maybe in 1983, it was still possible. And so what emotional labor used to be, again, a sort of facet of certain jobs that were a much smaller part of the total workforce in this country. If you are working on an assembly line, it does not matter if you smile at the car as it comes by you or say, fuck you, car, as it comes by you. As long as you do the thing that you need to do, screw the screw or, paint the thing or whatever it is that you need to do, attach the door, it doesn't matter how you feel about it. And so when, again, these industrial jobs disappear and the thing that takes their place is healthcare work, it's service work, it's restaurant work, it's a lot of the jobs people are quitting right now in what we're calling the Great Resignation. These are jobs where you do have to sort of school your face into a certain thing in order to do the job properly. This is also true of things like teaching, right? Healthcare work, you have to do a certain amount of emotional labor. Imagine you're a doctor who just told somebody they're dying. You have to manage your feelings in order to manage their feelings. And so this is something that, you know, it gets talked about a lot in sort of very broad terms, like any kind of emotion you might have about work. But I think it's really important to understand it as a form of production, right? The goal of emotional labor is to produce a feeling in somebody else. And that's both really hard to quantify, right? Unlike a car coming off an assembly line, and also the thing that is, you know, that your boss is getting surplus value from.
Well, I guess the next question is, and I think this may frame quite a bit of the conversation, because I think there's going to lead to a series of questions, but is the gendered aspect of this, right? Mm-hmm. That a lot of what you're describing is the end of, in what in many cases were very traditional male forms of work, such as the auto factory and the steel mill, mm-hmm. and the replacement with things that were traditionally female forms of work, such as education, healthcare, et cetera. So even if it's a lot of men now going into those fields. You know, could you talk a little bit more about the gendered aspect of all of this and the ways in which, you know, given what those workforce looks like now, which is much more gender diverse than the original bifurcation of the labor force in America, mm-hmm. how that sort of impacts, how that impacts the entire construction of emotional labor.
Yeah, there are a lot of aspects to this, right? One is sort of the disappearance of what, you know, I jokingly call manly man jobs for men, and the replacement of those with, you know, either crappy warehouse work or service work. Another one of those is that, as I was saying, when an emotion is the product that you are producing, and it's much harder to put a monetary value on that, it's much easier to discount the skill of producing that emotion. That it's not really hard to do. And as somebody who waited tables for around 10 years, that is a lie. It is very difficult to do when you were having a bad day and somebody just grabbed your ass at work to continue to smile and not punch them in the throat. And like the way that set us up to discount certain things as skills and assume that certain kinds of work are unskilled, and more importantly, that they're naturally things that women are good at, right? That instead of it being a skill that you learn to do to control your feelings when you are teaching preschool or bartending, it's just a thing that women are good at. Women are good at feelings. Women are good with kids, right? Women are good at taking care of sick people. And that leads to undervaluing of those skills. And so what we see in these fields that are, you know, dominated by women still, right? Teaching is 70, 72, 75% women, more so in lower grades. High as the kids get older, the percentage of men gets higher and the prestige accorded to it gets higher too. Nursing, which is still 90% women, also there, male nurses tend to get paid more even compared to people who are doing the same work because it's seen as a skill when men do it because it's not presumed to be something they're naturally good at. This was also true, by the way, in the factory, right? Where we assumed that like women couldn't work in the factory because we are, I don't know, weak and frail and cry a lot. And so these presumptions, I mean, both ways, they sort of rebound badly on me. On women, because we are assumed to not be good at certain things, and the things we are good at are just natural and they don't require sort of remuneration. So the moment that we're in now, which you know, historian Bethany Morton once described as like, you know, it's not that women are in exciting CEO jobs, it's that men get to be casualized clerks. That's the real change of the economy since the 70s. That means that men are having to do a bunch of work that they were not prepared for with these skills as children. It was not drilled into them that they were naturally good at smiling when somebody is rude to you or whatever it is. And that we have sort of lost a whole framework for talking about these things as, again, as things that you learn to do as part of skilled labor. And that has driven wages down for everyone. Yay.
Well, and I guess, you know, I mean, when we think about, you know, loving our job, so to speak, right, that I think that historically there's kind of a two ways of this sort of played out, right? And they're very gendered. So, you know, a lot of what you're describing is, of course, traditional female work. And of course, as you accurately point out, nobody has to love the auto, right? Like the in the car factory, nobody loves their job. In fact, they're pretty open about mostly hating their job.
Yes.
But, right, there's this producerist value that was very masculine, right? That even if we hated working in this auto factory, we were still making a car, and there was this value placed upon that, which itself had been historically, you know, changed because it comes out of the old craft labor stuff where you really could be proud of what it is you did, but there was still this identification with producerism. And then, you know, when we think about the present, there is this sort of, you know, especially on the left and things, you know, where a lot of us are talking about the future of work. There's this, you know, I think one of the realities that we face is that there's not really a very much of a place for this producerism in the contemporary economy, but yet it's still very heavily felt, especially among men.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering, I don't know that if that's really even a question, but the sort of the roles in which these ideologies, whether it's loving your work or loving producing something, frames our contemporary work experience where neither one is being satisfied.
Right. And I think there's sort of different things, right? Where people will sort of talk about this, like, oh, humans really like love to, you know, feel meaning and useful, and therefore we love work. And it's like, yeah, you can separate like meaningful things that you might do with your time from wage labor fairly easily, actually. Just look at all of the unpaid work that women mostly are still doing in the home. But also, like, so I think about this a lot in the conversation around the Green New Deal, for instance, right? Where it gets framed in very producerist terms a lot of the time. When like, and the reality is, of course, and you are an environmental historian and know this better than I do, we actually have to stop producing so much shit because we're setting the planet on fire.
Yep.
And so, you know, and like Alyssa Battistoni writes about this, right? The way that like for a sort of green transition, there's going to be a lot of, for lack of a better term, manly man jobs for men early on in terms of retrofitting and construction and whatever. But actually, once you've built the solar panels or the wind turbine or whatever, they don't need a lot of maintenance. It's not like you have to keep yanking oil out of the ground the same way that, you know, right now we have people like dying on offshore oil platforms to do, or still in a few coal mines around the world. There are still some of those. It doesn't take as much work. And so that's actually going to like radically change our relationship to what needs to be done. Once again, like as a society, what needs to be done to keep humans existing, to keep from setting the planet on fire, that's going to end up being a lot of care work. And it also hopefully means we all work a lot less. And the thing that worries me in this conversation is that like Joe Biden, I mean, whatever Joe Biden, but like Joe Biden's out there giving speeches in front of Mack trucks about how we're going to, you know, bring the factories home, which by the way, is not going to happen. And we are not going to deal with this sort of masculinist producerist idea that is itself sort of linked to the sort of capitalist colonial view of the world as a thing that we must dominate and take from, that is part of the reason that we're setting the planet on fire in the first place. So this is some stuff that's not in my book, but it is deeply related to, I think, why it's important to have these conversations now. And the pandemic, you know, whatever wave we're in here, did give us at least one tool for talking about that, which is this question of essential labor. What is the work that is absolutely essential to keep us alive? And what is the work that is, you know, I remember the Amazon workers who walked out, one of the early walkouts, they were talking about like having to like mail rubber chickens. And they were like, I'm coming into this warehouse, risking my life to send you a rubber chicken. Like, no, you don't need that. Nobody needs that. And I shouldn't risk my life for it.
You know,
and, yeah, well, we shouldn't set the planet on fire for rubber chickens either.
Well, I guess this question of, you know, essential labor, is one that's obviously in the conversation right now. I mean, I imagine that probably a lot of the book was written before the pandemic really hit. you right. know, and yes. you kind of make those adjustments because of the, you know, the schedule of publishing.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not really an issue that you get into too much in the book, but, you know, in these particular kinds of jobs, whether it's meat packers or it's grocery store clerks or other, or it's healthcare, you know, this sort of bifurcation, I guess, of that you are doing this labor and you're a hero, right? You're a hero right. for doing this labor. Meanwhile, nobody asked to be a hero going and working
right, exactly.
in the grocery store, right? That's not yeah. what you're there for. And I'm exactly. wondering, like, this hero rhetoric that comes out of the pandemic feels to me, I guess, like another form of emotional labor. Because you are sort of having this thrust upon you, but what is not being thrust upon you is like higher wages. Yeah, exactly. Or
an N95 or, mask, perhaps. Yeah,
exactly. You know, yeah. so I think that's like another aspect of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are two things about that, right? One is that like there was an extra amount of emotional labor. There's a really good piece at Tribune Magazine by Holly Smith. That's SMYTHE about her work as a grocery store clerk and this man coming in and just like, early on in the pandemic and just like grabbing her hand as she handed him stuff and was just like, I'm sorry, I live alone. Like he just like desperately needed human contact and that kind of work. And I heard versions of that story from several people who worked in grocery stores, pharmacies, things like that, you know, that they were having particularly like elderly customers who lived alone come in and just be desperate for human contact. And I feel it, man, like the doorman at the building I was living in last winter, like without them, I just, you know, I give very big Christmas tips. We'll say that. Because I was just like aware that I'm putting a lot of like whatever on like the sole interaction with a human I have every day, which is like asking the doorman if my package has arrived. And so that was one big aspect of it, right? That like these jobs that also got physically more dangerous also got sort of emotionally more fraught than they already were. And they're already fraught. And then the other part of it is that like this kind of clapping for carers and, you know, cheer for the healthcare workers and you're all heroes and all these billboards saying, thank you. That stuff curdles really quickly. You know, and it very quickly turns into like, we clapped for you. How dare you? And we've seen this, of course, over the last 40 years with teachers in America, right? Where like teachers are heroes. Teachers are wonderful. How dare you? It's your fault that our children are failing. You know, and particularly during the pandemic, teachers came in for a lot of that with things like, why don't you go back into the schools? We're sick of having our children at home. They're driving us nuts. So we need the teachers to go back in, even though the pandemic is still raging. And we just need to reopen the schools because we can't have our kids around anymore. Because, you know, again, capitalism piles all this on top of people and then gives us no form of childcare. And the schools are the one form of sort of child supervision that happened. And when the pandemic separated the work of teaching your child from the work of supervising your child to make sure they don't go drown in a lake or get hit by a car, that sort of showed how much we rely on children or on teachers and public schools for the latter and kind of don't actually value the former. Like I talked to a bunch of teachers who are making themselves like just nuts trying to figure out ways to like keep a classroom of 7-year-olds entertained on Zoom. What is the attention span of the average 7-year-old? Then they're in front of a computer all day. Like, you know, imagine how much harder that job got. And you're worrying about your students and their families and everything else. And you're worried about your own health because they're trying to force you back into the classroom. And yeah, so this entire sort of gratitude blame, you know, dare I say dialectic, it can get really nasty really quickly. And it's not a thing that you can like code into a union contract, right? That like, everybody's going to appreciate us. Like, no, you can code into a union contract that like, you're not going back into the classroom until COVID numbers fall below a certain number in your immediate area. You could put that in the union contract. You can't put like, the parents won't get mad at us in there.
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean, I my thought, you know, from the very beginning was that this hero, it very much relates to the ways we talk about the military, which is that the discussion of heroes, it's all about the person saying it. It's not actually about the individual right, receiving exactly. the so-called compliment. But I guess, you know, there's like a, you know, teachers, of course, is one of the chapters of your book, and it's an important one. And the teachers' labor move, you know, the labor movement has been driven by teachers in no small extent over the last decade or a little more than that now. And, you know, it seems like in the sort of successful teacher strikes over the last 4 or 5 years, that they've been able to sort of take that emotional labor expectations and use it in their favor in terms of the ways in which they are able to frame their strikes. Like, yes, you know, we're striking for money, but we're also striking so like your kid has a nurse and a library.
Right, exactly.
And so is there sort of a way, I mean, building on that, are there ways that that you see that this emotional labor or this idea of loving your job can be marshaled to help workers?
I think it's really fraught to do that, right? It can be dangerous, but yeah, teachers have done a very good job of this. And nurses also, I mean, I've been sort of obsessively covering the St. Vincent nurses strike in Worcester, Massachusetts. They've been out for about 9 months now. And the thing that they do very well in both sort of nurses and teacher strikes is they make it very clear that the thing you're striking about is going to affect like your students' learning conditions, your patients' healthcare conditions, right? Particularly with nurses who actually tend to be paid fairly decently because there's been a longstanding nursing shortage in this country. So most of the time when there's a nurse's strike, it is going to be about staffing levels. It's going to be about their patient care conditions. And they lead with that, you know, sort of first and foremost. We cannot do a good job of caring for our patients because we have 5 patients per nurse and that's too many. You know, that kind of argument can cut through because they are saying like, no, we do love our job and we do care about our patients. And it is because we care about our patients and about doing our job well that we need this, this, and this in our contract, right? That we need you to hire 10 more nurses, that we need you to take that nurse to patient ratio down to 3 or 4. That we need to have like a rotating nurse on the floor every shift so that if, you know, 2 of my patients have coded at the same time, somebody can be somewhere. And the same with teachers, right? This is the thing that the Chicago Teachers Union did really well and that has been replicated across the country. And people are now trying to replicate it in other countries, was saying our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And our students do not learn well when there's 40 of them in a classroom, especially when that classroom was like made for 25 people and now there's 40 students in it. That, you know, our kids don't learn well when there's no toilet paper in the restroom and they can't pee. Our kids don't learn well when they haven't eaten breakfast that morning. Those kinds of demands that get woven in there with like, also, by the way, teachers, you know, it would help if they could pay the rent in the city where they live. Stuff like that is kind of important. And so again, we've seen success with that in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in a variety of other places that have really made those demands central. And like in West Virginia, where the teachers strike included demands for better health insurance for every public employee, not just the teachers, they still managed to use the leverage that they have as teachers and the relationships they had in the community to actually make a demand that was bigger than just them, but that actually was about everybody who worked for the state of West Virginia.
So, but there is a downside to this.
Yeah. People have asked me a lot since the book came out, right? What is your advice for people? And I'm like, unionize your job. And they're like, no, really, what is your advice? And I'm like, really, join a union. Because ultimately, you know, these aren't problems we can solve individually by having a better work-life balance and a better sort of relationship with your job. There are problems that need to be solved collectively at the level of the workplace, at the level of society, at the level of we're not getting anything from the PRO Act and the freaking Senate bill because Joe Manchin. Yay, President Joe Manchin. Like, we have to actually think about these things as questions that we need to answer for everyone, regardless of how they feel about their job. Because not everybody who teaches is going to have the same relationship to teaching. Not everybody who is a journalist has the same relationship to being a journalist. Not everybody who delivers the mail has the same relationship to being a mail carrier, right? Like, and that's okay, because they should all have the same rights and freedoms, regardless of whether you like your job or not. And what the love your job sort of story tells us is if you don't love your job, it is your problem and you should quit your job and go find another one. And this is, you know, the great resignation. Hello. But one of the things that I keep sort of cautioning people about this great resignation narrative is that while I would love there to be a massive anti-work movement happening in America and the world, what's actually happening, as Rebecca Given put on our podcast on Belabored this week, is like the great job shift. People are taking one job and telling it to shove it, but they are looking for another job. And they're taking advantage of a relatively tight labor market. Although again, Omicron is looming, so who the hell knows, in order to maybe find a better job. So this still fits sort of solidly in this neoliberal narrative of work that tells us that if you don't like your job, it is a problem for you personally to solve rather than a problem for us collectively as a society by passing better labor legislation, and, you know, regulating capital and all of these fun things that we could do if we had a functional political system. We are still seeing people mostly reacting to this on an individual level rather than a collective action level. Although some of this uptick in particularly private sector strikes this fall gives us some hope that we can see some of this being handled collectively. And some of these conversations about things like working time and unrealistic expectations of devotion to your job are getting into the public conversation a little more.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to ask one last question, there's so much we could ask, and you know, this has been a very broad-ranging conversation generally, but it's, I guess, on this issue of time, right? That you know, traditionally, for so much of the labor movement's history, time was in many ways more important than wages, right? I mean, it was control over your life was the central issue, particularly of 19th and early 20th century labor history.
Right.
And then, you know, Fordism comes in and it really, and the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act, and it kind of sets the 8-hour day and it kind of regulates this time. And right. Then in a post-industrial society, time has become a kind of a once again, like a, well, it's almost become a neoliberal commodity. Right. Mm-hmm. That your time, it's like the gig economy, right? Well, you have this time, mm-hmm. like you should go drive and make a little bit of extra money or whatever.
Right, exactly. So
I'm wondering, like, this sort of this connection between time, the labor of love, and the great resignation. Like, are we seeing, even if people are kind of just shifting jobs, is it to a certain extent like an attempt to reestablish control over your personal time, even if it's happening mm-hmm. in a neoliberal individualistic way and not right. in a collective action right. way?
I think it's a good sign in general that people are telling their bosses to F off, because I am always in favor of people telling their bosses to F off. And the challenge for you and me and everybody on the left who think that we should have a lot more control over our time and over the work we have to do is to figure out how to turn that into organized power. The thing about sort of demands for the 8-hour day, even the 10-hour day, is that those could be broad. Again, they didn't require you to have a certain relationship with your job or not. They were for everyone. The 8-hour day strike would take the whole city out, right? And it was women who were doing childcare work. It was laundry workers. It was factory workers. It was craft labor. It was everybody could say like, yeah, we should work less. And by the way, you still have to pay us the same. And so the rise of demands for like a 4-day week, which is getting bigger in Europe than it is here, but we've been trying to sort of bring it back in here, are a sign that people are thinking about this and just going like, actually, maybe like work is not the thing that I want to be doing with my whole day, my whole life, my whole whatever. And I think one of the things, and this is me getting sort of metaphysical here, but like one of the things that spending the last almost 2 years living constantly thinking about death has done for a lot of us, me included, is make us really think about like what matters. You know, especially right, like, you know, first lockdown when we had no idea what was going on. We had no idea exactly how this virus was transmitted. We were just locked up with like ourselves and a small number of people, whether that be like immediate family, partners, in my case, it was roommates. You start to think really hard about what you miss. You know, I was so excited when I got to go see live music again this fall. It's like, oh my God, I'm at a show. This is incredible. I have missed this so much. And like, I bet for a lot of people, you didn't think about how much you missed work. And one of the things that happened, especially again during the first lockdown, was that we got like expanded unemployment. So people who got laid off got the experience of being out of work, but not having to panic about money. And in fact, because we're such a low-wage country, bumping up unemployment to 15 bucks an hour meant that you had a bunch of people in this country who got paid more for unemployment than whatever. And, you know, the Republicans and a bunch of Joe Manchin types are all saying, oh, that's terrible. We should have work requirements. But actually, that's amazing because people got to experience their life without for a minute having to calculate, if I don't make money in this moment, can I pay the rent? And so, you know, and in places like the UK where they had a furlough scheme that the money, rather than coming through unemployment, it came through your employer. So I had friends who just had like several months off and they were getting paid like, I don't know, it was like 70 or 80% of their regular income by the government through their employer to still have their job, but not work. That did give you an experience of like, oh, do I miss my job? What do I miss in these moments when I'm locked down and don't have anything to do? Is it work? And I think that, you know, that coupled with the experience that a lot of people had, which is your boss doesn't care if you die, as long as, you know, surplus value keeps rolling, is contributing to a lot of this now. And I don't have data for this. I just have anecdotes of being a labor journalist over the last 2 years, which means I've talked to a lot of people. And so I think that, you know, it's hard to quantify, obviously. If I could design a survey on this, I would be asking a lot of sort of wanky questions about this stuff, though, because it would just be like, yeah, what actually gives you meaning? And did your understanding of that change over the last 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, I just will close by saying I completely agree. I mean, I think that the long-term consequences of that expanded unemployment, we'll see what they are, but I think they may be significant because, you know, I think that it just gave a lot of time, a lot of people time when they were home to sit around and think like, do I like this, my role in the economy? Right. And the answer is no, like it sucks. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to do this anymore. And, you know, where this leads to a year from now, 2 years from now, I don't know. Right. Again, like, as you point out, it's very hard to quantify because it's just happening right now. And I don't know that a lot of people are asking the right questions about it, but it sure is a fascinating moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really the thing that worries me now is, again, we have another wave looming and the powers that be, capital and our, you know, political overlords have realized that giving people expanded benefits raised our expectations, to use Jane McAlevey's term, right? And that makes me worry that we're not going to get any more of it for this wave. And that's going to be really frightening, especially for, again, a lot of people in the service industry who are going to see their incomes just again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what happens. I guess, though, you know, maybe the political pressures will rise. Or hopefully they do. But anyway, I know
that's
you
have our to go. Job, right?
Exactly. I know you have to run and I know you're very busy. And I want to thank you very much, Sarah, for joining us today. We were talking to Sarah Jaffe about her new book, as well as various other contemporary labor issues, but her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. And I'd say at the end of the semester, it sure feels like that to me. So so anyway, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll be back soon with another LGM podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.